Morning, brethren and sisters. As we begin to look into this third chapter of Deuteronomy, we'll quickly recall where we left off yesterday in chapter 2. And as chapter 2 concludes, we read of the Israelites conquering Sihon, king of Heshbon, and all of his cities. And we'll read the last few verses of that chapter very quickly. Verse 34, "And we took all his cities at that time, and utterly destroyed the men and the women, and the little ones of every city. We left none to remain. Only the cattle we took for a prey unto ourselves, and the spoil of the cities which we took. From Aroer, which is by the brink of the river Arnon, and from the city that is by the river, even unto Gilead, there was not one city too strong for us. Yahweh our Elohim delivered all unto us." Now, immediately following this account of the conquering of Heshbon, we begin chapter 3. To better manage this chapter, we can break the 29 verses into five smaller sections. The first section we will cover includes the first 11 verses, and its main theme is the further victory that the Israelites have over Og, king of Bashan. The first verse is worded in such a way that which implies that Og, who happened to be an ally of Sihon, marched against the Israelites without any provocation. Reading verse 1, "Then we turned and went up the way to Bashan," and this indicates that the tribes were peacefully surveying the land. Continuing on in that verse, we read, "And Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei." And the end of this verse suggests that Og had a very prideful attitude and was very confident that he could defeat the children of Israel. Now, the name of the city where they fought, the city of Edrei, signifies mighty, which makes sense because the city was very strongly fortified. And we know that earlier in the wilderness, the Israelites were quick to shy away from fighting the nations, which appeared to be stronger than them. However, Yahweh strengthens the Israelites in verse 2 and tells them to fear not. With the recent victory over Sihon and the rest of Heshbon, it is undeniable that Israel would feel more confident fighting against Og. Verses 3 through verse 6 give us a similar account to what we read concerning the victory over Sihon. "So Yahweh our Elohim delivered into our hands Og also, the king of Bashan, and all his people, and we smote him until there was none left to him remaining. And we took all his cities at that time, there was not a city which we took not from them, 80 cities, all the region of Argob, the kingdom of Og in Bashan. All these cities were fenced with high walls, gates, and bars, beside unwalled towns a great many. And we utterly destroyed them as we did unto Sihon, king of Heshbon, utterly destroying the men, women, and children of every city." And now we can learn a few things from these verses, both literally and symbolically. Firstly, the cities of Bashan that were utterly destroyed were 80 cities, and every city, as verse 5 says, was strongly fortified against attackers. Along with the strong cities, there were also many rural villages outside the cities, and these were completely destroyed as well. Secondly, in verse 6, we make a connection with the destruction of Sihon. Now, in both cases for Og and Sihon, all of the men, women, and children were slain. And we know in today's world it would seem cruel and unusual to completely exterminate a nation, but it was a necessity for Israel if they wanted to survive. Now, there were two possible outcomes for the Israelites in any situation where they were commanded to completely wipe out the nations around them. Either they would exterminate the pagan worshippers, or they would allow the pagan beliefs into the midst of Israel, thus corrupting the nation as a whole. And the second outcome, where they would let the pagan beliefs into the camp, is symbolic of the seed of the serpent in relation to the people of God. A quote from the Expositor, "Whilst the hand of mercy is always extended to those who wish to take hold of it, the only safe course for the righteous is to exterminate the wicked. The doctrine of the atonement teaches that. It ordains that defilement is easily transmitted one to the other, whereas holiness is much more difficult to acquire. The continued existence, let alone the prosperity of Israel, depended upon the people faithfully carrying out what Yahweh knew was best for them, though the flesh might philosophize otherwise. The Amorites and the people like them stood in relationship to Israel as sin in the flesh does to the saint in Christ. He is required to ruthlessly suppress such motions of the flesh." brethren and sisters, we must do our best to exterminate the worldly things in our lives, just as the children of Israel were required to do to the Canaanites. It is a very difficult task for us to do as we live amongst the world, but we are commanded to do our best to not be a part of the world. We are to do our best to emulate the ways of Christ, for he is our best example of how to overcome our natural fleshly desires. If we do not remove the things of the world from our lives, we will end up like ancient Israel did, wicked and perverse in our beliefs and actions. We read over the next few verses about the spoil taken by the Israelites, and it is reiterated that they took all the land that belonged to the two kings of the Amorites on the east side of the Jordan River, even from the river Arnon unto Mount Hermon. And there's an interesting fact we learn in verse 11 when it says, "For only Og, king of Bashan, remained of the remnant of the giants." Now, the Hebrew word giants signifies to be stretched out, which relates to how tall these people were. If we read in, or if we reference Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, we read, "There were giants in the earth in those days," and that is the days of Noah, "and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown." However, we read in this verse that Og was the last of the remnant of the giants. Moving on to verse 12, we begin the second small section of this chapter, and that goes from verses 12 to 17, and this is where we get a record of how the newly acquired land was distributed to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. We can find the original account of this in Numbers chapter 32, which we'll quickly read verses 1 through 9 from that. Numbers 32, verse 1, "Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that, behold, that place was a place for cattle. The children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spake unto Moses and to Eleazar the priest and unto the princes of the congregation, saying, Ataroth and Dibon and Jazer and Nimrah and Heshbon and Elealeh and Shebam and Nebo and Beon, even the country which Yahweh smote before the congregation of Israel, is a land for cattle, and thy servants have cattle. Wherefore they, said they, if we have found grace in thy sight, let this land be given unto thy servants for a possession, and bring us not over Jordan. And Moses said unto the children of Gad and to the children of Reuben, Shall your brethren go to war, and shall ye sit here? And wherefore discourage ye the heart of the children of Israel from going over into the land which Yahweh hath given them? Thus did your fathers, when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up unto the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the children of Israel, that they would not go into the land which Yahweh had given them." Moses brings out an important point here to the 2.5 tribes. The Israelites were easily influenced, and because of this, it was essential for all the people to stick together and fight courageously. We can recall verse 28 from chapter 1 yesterday, where the people say, "Whither shall we go up? Our brethren have discouraged our heart, saying, The people is greater and taller than we. The cities are great and walled up to heaven. Moreover, we have seen the sons of the Anakims there." So it's easy to assume if the 2.5 tribes did not cross the Jordan and fight with the remaining tribes, that the 9.5 tribes would be discouraged and afraid to conquer the land. In response to this claim by Moses, the tribes make an agreement in verses 16 through 23 of that 32nd chapter. It says, "And they came near unto him and said, We will build sheepfolds here for our cattle and cities for our little ones, but we ourselves will go ready armed before the children of Israel until we have brought them unto their place. And our little ones shall dwell in the fenced cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return unto our houses until the children of Israel have inherited every man his inheritance. For we will not inherit with them on yonder side Jordan or forward, because our inheritance is fallen to us on this side Jordan eastward. And Moses said unto them, If ye will do this thing, if ye will go armed before Yahweh to war, and will go all of you armed before Jordan, over Jordan before Yahweh, until he hath driven out his enemies from before him, and the land be subdued before Yahweh, then afterward ye shall return and be guiltless before Yahweh and before Israel, and this land shall be your possession before Yahweh. But if ye will not do so, behold, ye have sinned against Yahweh, and be sure your sin will find you out." Now this record of the agreement made between Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh with Moses will take us into the third section of our study chapter, which is in verses 18 through 20, where the two and a half tribes are reminded of their responsibilities to help the rest of the nation on the west side of the Jordan. There is an interesting type that can be found in the 18th verse. Moses tells them, And I commanded you at that time, saying, Yahweh your Elohim hath given you this land to possess it. Ye shall pass over armed before your brethren, the children of Israel, all that are meet for the war. And once again, we can reference Numbers 32, verse 21, which we just read. And in that verse, the Canaanites are referred to Yahweh's enemies, thus showing that the army of Israel was recruited by Yahweh for a holy war to destroy these enemies. Quoting again from the expositor, we read, "The cause of the war was the complete repudiation of Yahweh's standards of morality by the Canaanites, whose iniquity was now full. Nations cannot please themselves as to what they do or how they act. Even though not in covenant relationship with Yahweh, they are held accountable for their doings. At the coming of the Lord, the Gentiles will be judged as were the Canaanites when Joshua entered the land, but this time by Christ and the immortalized saints." Verse 18 ends with the saying, "all that are meet for the war." And the Hebrew expression for this saying is "sons of valor" or "of power." It denotes specially selected soldiers trained for the purpose that Moses had in mind, and not merely those who were of an age to fight. And again, this points forward to Christ and the immortalized saints, who will have been specifically chosen to execute judgment on the nations. The fourth section of this chapter is in verses 21 and 22, and in the section, Moses exhorts Joshua to put his trust in Yahweh once the leadership is turned over to him. Joshua had been a witness to the many miracles Yahweh performed for the Israelites since their exodus from the land of Egypt, and this undoubtedly would have strengthened his confidence in Yahweh. Joshua's steadfast faith in Yahweh can be contrasted to the faithless spies who were deterred by the sight of their eyes, thus weakening the hearts of the people. At that time, Joshua was undeterred by the giants of the land, as he acknowledged that Yahweh would doubtlessly deliver them into the hands of the Israelites. And Joshua never forgets this encouragement from Moses, and he even gives a similar message to the men of Israel after a great victory over the five kings of the land of Canaan. We can read in Joshua chapter 10, verse 25, "And Joshua said unto them, Fear not, nor be dismayed, be strong and of good courage, for thus shall Yahweh do to all your enemies against whom ye fight." This should be a powerful lesson to us, brothers and sisters. If we wholly put our trust into Yahweh, we should be strong and of good courage, just like Joshua was. Now, the final section of this chapter begins with Moses asking one last time for permission to enter into the Promised Land. However, his prayer is answered to his dismay as Yahweh denies Moses entry into the land and tells him to speak no more of this matter. Moses is told that he will be allowed to view the land from the top of Pisgah, and we know that he was to die soon after. He is also told to encourage and strengthen Joshua once more, for he will lead the people and cause them to inherit the land. Now, to conclude these remarks, we'll take a closer look into verse 26 and some of the types that can be found therein. Verse 26 says, "But Yahweh was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And Yahweh said unto me, Let it suffice thee. Speak no more of this matter, or speak no more unto me of this matter." This verse explains why Moses was denied entrance into the land. It was for your sakes Yahweh refused Moses' request in order to impress the people with the need for strict obedience to his commands. This incident is recorded in Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 through 29. In smiting the rock twice, Moses typed those who heed not Yahweh's words. But, as we read in Hebrews 6:6, those who crucify to themselves the Son of God afresh and put him to an open shame. The fate of all such, as well as those who rest on obedience to the law as the means of justification, was typified by Moses being refused entrance into the land. The refusal was designed to teach a lesson to whosoever should heed. Moses represented the law. God's refusal to permit him to enter the land demonstrated that the law of itself was unable to save. it was unable to do so because of the weakness of the flesh, which we can reference to Romans 8:3. It is beyond the ability of the flesh, unaided, to render perfect obedience to God. Hence, the law could only condemn. The manifestation of grace and forgiveness was and is necessary for salvation. His was demonstrated to the people of Israel when Moses was denied entrance into the land, despite the divine assessment of his character as exceeding in virtue that of all others at that time. If such a man as that could not enter therein, what hope could any have apart from grace? So the law was a schoolmaster leading unto Christ. Of course, Moses will ultimately receive the recompense of the reward. He will receive it through the ministry of that one whom he typed. Refusal of Moses' request, therefore, taught powerful lessons. Firstly, it emphasized the need of obedience, and secondly, it taught that the law, because of the weakness of flesh, could not of itself provide salvation. In that way, it pointed to the need of Christ. And lastly, there is one more lesson that we can take from verse 26. Yahweh had a purpose in denying Moses his request to enter the land. As noted previously, it demonstrated that the Israelites could not enter their eternal inheritance by the law. The refusal of Moses' request was similar to the refusal of Yahweh to the request of Paul. He prayed several times that the thorn in his flesh, that is, his bad eyesight, might be removed in order that he may be able to serve Yahweh better. But he was told, "My grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." And that's found in 2 Corinthians 12:9. Paul's thorn in the flesh provided a powerful exhortation, for he did not permit it to deter him from the work before him. He continued to labor in the things of God and faith, and so presented a living exhortation to all who might take heed. Brethren and sisters, no matter what trials we may be going through, we must strive to serve Yahweh with all our heart, mind, and strength. We will not be tried any more than we can handle, so it is important for us to make the best of any situation we are put in order to serve Yahweh more perfectly. I look forward to hearing comments from the brethren.